a wonderful time for book distribution. And if you didn't get an opportunity, please see Mother Shrivindavan in the back and get some books. Even if one or two, whatever you want to sponsor, or would you like to take some books to distribute to your friends, workers, relatives, it's just a very, very wonderful opportunity. We find that this time of year, because it's the Christmas season in America, people are in a very receptive mood. Therefore, I decided to give a class today on what we call the peace formula, because this is a time when people talk about peace on earth. Everybody wants peace, but most people do not know how to find it. Fortunately, the Bhagavad Gita is going to show us how. So we'll begin. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we'll read today from the Srimad Bhagavatam. This is Chapter 5, Karma Yoga, Action of Krishna Consciousness, the last verse of the chapter, text 29. It's a very familiar verse, I'm sure, to many people, students of the Bhagavad Gita. It's a wonderful synopsis of Chapter 5 and sort of gives us a wonderful instruction from Krishna. So I'll just read through the Sanskrit and English. If you want, you can chant along. Bhoktaram jagyatapasam sarvaloka maheshvaram suhridim sarvabhutanam gyatva mam shantim richtati. You notice this word shantim, which means peace or relief from material pangs. So now we will hear about the peace formula. Translation purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. A person in full consciousness of me, knowing me to be the ultimate beneficiary of all sacrifices and austerities, the supreme lord of all planets and demigods, and a benefactor and well-wisher of all living entities, attains peace from the pangs of material miseries. Srila Prabhupada's purport. I'll read the first long paragraph. After that, Prabhupada continues to give a synopsis of the chapter, so I won't read that today. Purport. The conditioned souls within the clutches of illusory energy are all anxious to attain peace in the material world. But they do not know the formula for peace, which is explained in this part of the Bhagavad Gita. The greatest peace formula is simply this. Lord Krishna is the beneficiary in all human activities. Men should offer everything to the transcendental service of the Lord, because he is the proprietor of all planets and the demigods thereon. No one is greater than he. He is greater than the greatest of the demigods, Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma. In the Vedas, Svetashvatara Upanishad 6-7, Supreme Lord is described as Tam Ishvaranam Paramahameshvaram. Under the spell of illusion, living entities are trying to be lords of all they survey, but actually they are dominated by the material energy of the Lord. The Lord is the master of material nature, and the conditioned souls are under the stringent rules of material nature. Unless one understands these bare facts, it is not possible to achieve peace in this world, either individually or collectively. This is the sense of Krishna consciousness. Lord Krishna is the supreme predominator of all living entities, including the great demigods are his subordinators. One can attain perfect peace only in complete Krishna consciousness. Om Jnana Tamrandasya Gnanjana Salakaya Chakshur Mitamina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Vanchakalpa Chubhischa Kripasindu Bhevacha Patitano Pavane Bhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha. So this is the time of the year when everyone talks about peace on earth. Everybody wants to have peace. Everyone is looking for it, talking about peace. And the Bhagavad Gita here, in the fifth chapter, Krishna tells us how we can achieve peace. So Srila Prabhupada has dubbed this the peace formula and often refers to this very, very important verse of the Bhagavad Gita as the formula to attain peace in this world. And that is, we can obtain peace if we understand that Krishna is one, the enjoyer of sacrifices, two, the lord of all the planets, three, the well-wisher of all living beings, and then one attains shantim, peace. Well, wonderful sentiments about peace. Do we see a lot of peace in this world? Not so much. Actually, this material world is filled with conflict. It is filled with fear. It is filled with what is described as the animal propensity of defending. Prabhupada quotes this verse from the Hitopadesh, which is one of the Upanishads. Ahara nidra bhaya matunam cha samanyam etat pashubir naranam dharmo hitesham ariko vishesho dharmena hina pashibi samana. Both animals and men share the activities of eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. Right? Human beings do these things, animals do these things. But the special property of the humans is they are able to engage in spiritual life. Therefore, without spiritual life, humans are on the level of animals. So we see that this fearing and defending, this bhaya, is part of material life. We see that this fearing is there within the animal kingdom. It's there all around us. You see one animal fighting with another or trying to attack another one, try to eat another one. And that same activity is also very prevalent in human society. But to the degree that that is our primary occupation, then we're really engaging in animal-like activities. So, a little research. One historian calculated that in the last 3,421 years of recorded history, how he came out with that 3,421, I'm not exactly sure, but as far back as he had good records, he said that of those over 3,000 years, there was only 268 years without a major war. You know, that's less than 5%. Another historian calculated back 5,560 years, which is about as far back. Once you get before Kali Yuga, Western historians are not very accurate. They don't really have a lot to say about what happened, even though the Vedic literatures, of course, have histories that go back millions of years. Nevertheless, in the last 5,560 years of recorded time, how many wars do you think there have been? How many major wars? Now you don't have no idea. 1,000? 5,000. More. 14,531. That's a lot of war. That's a lot of conflict. So there is no peace in this material world. So the question today is, why do we see so much conflict and why is there no peace in this material world? And Srila Prabhupada makes a very important point. He states in his purport, he says there is no peace, or it is not possible to achieve peace in the world either individually or collectively. So there's really two different issues here. There's two different perspectives. On a collective basis, we see that basically mankind's been almost at constant war. And then if we look at individually, do the individuals obtain peace in their life? And that's very important because the law of the universe is everything goes from subtle to gross, right? Things are manifested first on the subtle plane and then they become, they move into the world of action on the more gross plane of the material plane of existence. So in other words, if there's no peace in my life, in my heart, it's very unlikely that we're going to achieve a great deal of world peace. So why? Let's take a step back and look at the bigger picture. From a world perspective, or a universal perspective, we could say, we go through different ages, different cyclical patterns of times on Earth which are more godly or less godly, where there's more pious activity or less, where people are more devoted to pursuit of truth, pursuit of understanding God and our relationship with God, and times when those things become less and less part of our lives. And unfortunately, we are in one of those times called Kali Yuga. It's the fourth and the most disadvantaged, the worst time historically in the cycle of the earth for spiritual realization. This Kali Yuga is called the Age of Quarrel and Hypocrisy. Very aptly named for these 14,000 plus wars that we've had. Actually, since about the time Kali Yuga began 5,000 years ago. So, interestingly enough, the recorded history since about the beginning of Kali Yuga has shown this pattern of constant conflict. The 12th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam gives a very vivid description of the age of Kali. It predicts 5,000 years ago what will happen, what we will see taking place. I mean, some of it's amazing, the way they talk about corrupt leaders and fake news and things like that. It's really right there in the Bhagavatam. Bhagavad Gita 12, 3, 7, and 8 says, "For the sake of conquering me, materialistic persons fight with one another. Fathers oppose their sons and brothers fight one another because their hearts are bound to possessing political power." It's right from the Bhagavatam. "Political leaders challenge one another. All this land is mine. It is not yours, you fool." And thus they attack one another and die. So we see this is happening. And religious qualities become scarce. And more ungodly qualities become predominant. Of course, the ungodly qualities are described in the Bhagavad Gita, the 16th chapter. We have a whole chapter of the Bhagavad Gita dedicated to these people. And particularly in the verses 7 through 16 in that area, it describes these qualities of the asuras. It says, "They believe that to gratify the senses is the prime necessity of human civilization. Thus, until the end of their life, anxiety is immeasurable. Bound by a network of hundreds and thousands of desires and absorbed in lust and anger, they secure money by illegal means for sense gratification." And then we have the famous thought process. The asura thinks, "So much wealth do I have today, and I will gain more according to my schemes. So much is mine now, and it will increase in the future more and more. He is my enemy, and I have killed him, and my other enemies will also be killed. I am the lord of everything. I am the enjoyer. I am perfect, powerful, and happy. I am the richest man, surrounded by aristocratic relatives. There is none so powerful and happy as I am. I shall perform sacrifice. I shall give some charity. And thus I shall rejoice." In this way, such persons are deluded by ignorance. So we see that this greed is one of the basis of conflict. Greed for sense, personal sense enjoyment, greed for personal power, greed for one's own gratification at the expense of others. And we see, while this is an individual sentiment, it is often there on the national basis as well, where one country, an extension of that, one country will have their own ideas of national greed and wanting power and wanting to control others. So all of these things obviously feed into the state of war and the lack of peace that we find in the world. Now, we're not... Can I get some water? We are not saying that the world is filled with ungodly, greedy people. Fortunately, those people are a minority. Fortunately, they're a minority, but unfortunately, they have a lot of power at times, and they seem to have a lot of control. So there's a difference between those people who are devotees of God, those people who are materialistic, but yet they are pious, and those who are not impious. Those who are pious follow some rules. They follow some religious principles. They may have some personal motivation, or they may lack complete understanding, a devotion to God. We see examples of these in our Vedic literatures even. We find examples like karma yoga, where one does a certain amount of activities according to religious principles to gain some good result, some good karma, to gain some better life in the next lifetime. Or one follows the path of dharma, the Vedic culture. So these are pious activities. And in our Western civilization, our Western history, we find many philosophies, ethical philosophies. I was thinking of John Stuart Mill's utilitarianism. Utilitarianism talked about that we should try to strive for the greatest good for the greatest number of people. It's a good idea. It's pious. It's trying to do good for others. But the difficulty is, it's not really acting for the satisfaction of God. And if one is not on the spiritual platform, above the material modes of nature, even the mode of goodness, one does not really know how to act in the best interest of the planet, the best interest of oneself, and the best interest in serving the personality of Godhead. Is that indicating another war is starting? Or? What is that? So, even if one tries to act for good, one may be very unaware of the subtle laws of karma, sometimes not so subtle. We all know that karma indicates that whatever action that we perform, there's a reaction. So if I act for good, I receive a good result. If I act badly or impiously, there's a negative result. And so this happens not just individually, but it happens in whole societies and whole cultures. Now, this may surprise some of you to know, some of it may not surprise you, to be surprising to you, but one of the karmic reactions that brings about warfare, in other words, why is there war? What is that a reaction from? Yeah. Well, Srila Prabhupada points out that animal killing is one of the causes of war. People don't think about that so much. In other words, sometimes people are motivated to try to not eat meat or become vegetarian because it's healthy, or they may even have some idea of it's merciful to the animal. They don't want to kill animals. These are all very, very good. But it has an even greater impact in that as a whole society is killing animals, particularly the cow, the resultant concomitant karmic reaction will be an increase in wars. Srila Prabhupada first explained this to us in a letter to Satsvarup in 1968. He was talking about the anti-war protests, which those of you who are around like me, us old-timers, we remember those well. Some of us were tear-gassed on the march on Pentagon, but I won't digress into my sordid past. Anyway, many of the devotees at that time, of course, were involved in these movements, you know, because a lot of people had some pious activity. They wanted to stop war. They wanted peace. Here's what Srila Prabhupada said. He said, this political struggle is a reaction of karma. Both the opposing parties, namely the students who have taken shelters in the churches and the government force which is coming to arrest them, both of them are in the same category. Because if it were a question of meat eating or supporting slaughterhouses, both of them would agree. So the present situation is a reaction to man's sinful activities. We especially recommend that people restrain themselves from four kinds of primary sinful activities: illicit sex, intoxication, meat eating, and gambling. But all these fighting people are 100% addicted to all these habits. So if they are serious about mitigating the unpalatable situation of society, they must agree to accept Krishna consciousness. Otherwise, there's no possibility for peace in the world. So, from a spiritual perspective, understanding the cosmic situation of the age of Kali, understanding how karmic reaction is there for activities, we know that the only way that we can have a more peaceful situation in this world is by becoming God-conscious and by engaging in dharmic pious activities, and ultimately Krishna-conscious activities, or activities directly connected with the service, devotional service, to Krishna, the personality of Godhead. Now we might say, what about Krishna and Arjuna? This whole book is set on a battlefield of Kurukshetra. Sometimes people ask that. In fact, I really believe that, I don't just believe, it's obviously been stated, that it was almost deliberately set in this most difficult situation that might seem morally ambiguous to people. Because the question immediately arises, how could Arjuna engage in this ghastly warfare? And in fact, Arjuna didn't want to do this, right? This is the whole setting, the Bhagavad Gita in the first chapter. Arjuna is very upset, he's very distraught, he lays down his bow, he says, Krishna, I'm not going to fight. He said, it's not right, it's not moral, it's not ethical, it's a bad thing to do. And Arjuna was an intelligent, dharmic person. And he had very good reasons. Actually, here were some of his reasons. He said it's not good to fight because, one, no good can come of battle where relatives are killed. And he says killing is sinful and cannot bring happiness. Destruction of the family leads to irreligion. Number four, women will become degraded unwanted, and there will be unwanted progeny. Often this is the case in warfare. Five, community projects and welfare work will be devastated. And then he says, and they will all go to hell. In other words, committing sinful activity, killing people, there'll be no good reaction. So Arjuna's conclusion was, better that I be killed unarmed than engage in this warfare. Now, he had the proper religious and moral reasoning, but he was wrong. His reasoning was flawed. Why? Because it was not Krishna's desire. Krishna's desire was that this battle continued, that the Pandavas were restored to their rightful place as emperors of the world, that the evil demoniac leaders would be eliminated so that there could be real peace in the world. He had so many reasons. But the important thing, it was Krishna's reasons, God's reasons. So while we do not want to see war, we do not want to see suffering, we do everything we can to eliminate it, we are not exactly pacifists. We're pacifists if Krishna wants to be a pacifist. We do what Krishna wants us to do. And in this case, Arjuna was a Kshatriya. He was a fighter. That was his occupational duty. So Krishna says, you must perform that. But you must perform it for me. Then he says, of course, concludes in the 18th chapter's instructions, Sarvadharma Pratyaja, Mamekam Sharanam Vraja. All of these religious ideas, give them up and just surrender to me. That's the real religious instruction. That's the real Dharma, the real morality, is to follow the laws of God. So in the beginning, we were saying that beyond this universal conflict, reactionist sinful activities, there's also an individual or eternal, internal sense of peace or conflict. So we need to find peace within us as well. Right? We find that the jiva, the spirit soul, the consciousness often is disturbed. Often we do not have peace of mind. Why? Again, this is a symptom of Ajakali. It's described that lifespan will be diminished, the quality of goodness and kindness decreases, religious principles are broken down. And then right in the very beginning of the Bhagavatam, in the first chapter, when the sages are speaking and asking to get guidance in this age of Kali, they describe the situation of Kali Yuga. They say, in this iron age of Kali, men have but short lives. They are quarrelsome, lazy, misguided, unlucky, and above all, always disturbed. So they foretold my consciousness, my situation, exactly. This is all of our situation. We're all disturbed. Unless we have taken shelter of Krishna and Srila Prabhupada. But otherwise, the nature of life is to be disturbed. And just don't take my word for it. Is it, because you might say, is there really that much suffering? Isn't there a lot of good? Aren't there a lot of, yeah, yes, of course. But the reality is, this is the age of anxiety, and we see this constantly. Some statistics, again, don't take my word for it. This is the National Institute of Mental Health. In America, 48% of the population suffers one major mental disorder in their lifetime. In any given year, about 26% of the population is suffering some mental issues. 45% of college students reported feeling depression deep enough to prevent them from functioning. There's colleges kind of like that, does that to people? Here's an interesting one. There's a Gallup poll in 2008. Now, I realize that's a little dated, but 2008 is an interesting time in history because it was right after the big financial collapse, right? The Gallup poll found that 62% of Americans in the richest country of the world said that they were struggling or suffering. 62% of people say they're struggling or suffering. Now, since that, those numbers have come up a little bit. I follow these a little bit. They're kind of interesting. Actually, George Gallup, believe it or not, is kind of religious, and he does a lot of polls on religion, a lot of polls on people's sense of well-being and things like that. So sometimes some very interesting data. Here's a quick one I was just thinking of from Gallup. The Gallup polls have taken these like over time, and this is still current. So which country in the world has the most belief in God? Which country? America's number two. Very good. What's number one? India. The people who possess at least some sort of sense of God or spiritual life or something greater, number one is India, number two is America. Prabhupada came from India to America. He knew this was a ripe place to come to give Krishna consciousness. You know. So anyway, but nevertheless, even though a fairly religious country that we live in, many people still suffering, they're feeling the anxiety because they don't have full knowledge. They have a little knowledge, but not full knowledge. They haven't realized their relationship with God and acting in that relationship. And that is how we achieve peace. So we find the spirit soul within this material world is caught in a web of action and reaction. And the sinful activities are at the heart of our material entanglement. I don't have time for that. Anyway, Srila Prabhupada said in the Nectar Devotion, sinful activities are of two kinds, those which are mature and those not mature. The sinful activities which we are suffering in the present are called mature, and they come from our past activities. But we're also, due to our current activity, we're sort of laying the framework or the foundation for future sinful activities, for future suffering. So, he says, in this way, there's a chain of sinful activities that are concomitant distresses, and a conditioned soul suffering life after life due to this. So we need to get out of this cycle of suffering. Fortunately, the Bhagavad Gita gives us the path. To find peace individually and collectively, we must depend upon Krishna. And this Bhagavad Gita verse, we must understand these three aspects of Krishna. They're very clear, very simple. Actually, there's another very nice verse in the second chapter. It's similar in a sense. I also liked, and I'll read that one. This is Bhagavad Gita 2:66. Krishna says, one who is not connected with the Supreme can have neither transcendental intelligence nor a steady mind, without which there is no possibility of peace. And how can there be happiness without peace? Nice purport here. Srila Prabhupada says, it's confirmed in the fifth chapter, the verse we just read, that one who understands that Krishna is the only enjoyer of all the good results of sacrifice and penance, that he is the proprietor of all the universal manifestations, and he's the real friend of all living entities. Traveling with us is the super soul within the heart, life after life, birth after birth in this material world. When he understands these things, then only can one have real peace. Therefore, if one is not in Krishna consciousness, there cannot be a final goal for the mind. Disturbance is due to want of an ultimate goal. Interesting point. The disturbance of the mind is due to the want, the lacking, of an ultimate goal. And when one is certain that Krishna is the enjoyer, proprietor, and friend of everyone and everything, then one can, with a steady mind, bring about peace. Therefore, one who's engaged without a relationship with Krishna is certainly always in distress and is without peace, however much he makes a show of peace and spiritual advancement in life. This final line here, Krishna consciousness is a self-manifested peaceful condition which can be achieved only in relationship with Krishna. Self-manifested peaceful condition which we can achieve only in a relationship with Krishna. So to which we're almost at the end of time here. So to achieve peace for ourselves, for every one of us internally, we must have an ultimate goal. I'm saying this, without a goal, You won't be peaceful. You'll always be wondering, what is the purpose? What am I striving for? What is it all about? What's life all about? If one doesn't have that, one can't be satisfied. And we have to know what that final goal is. And one who does not have Krishna consciousness in their life does not have a final goal, does not have an ultimate goal, because Krishna is the ultimate. God is the ultimate. There's nothing beyond God. If there was something beyond God, that would be God, right? So there's nothing beyond God. There's nothing greater than God. If you can find anything, that would be God. It's like one of those self-referential logic things, you know, that you can't defeat, right? Whatever is the greatest, whatever is the ultimate, whatever is the absolute, that's God. And that's what we need to find. That is what it means to have an ultimate goal. And we understand from all of our Vedic literatures, from the gurus, our spiritual master, from all the acharyas, that that ultimate goal, that final absolute perfection of life, is Lord Sri Krishna. So that is what we're searching for. And, as Prabhupada said, that final goal is not just to find Krishna in some abstract way. Yes, I have some understanding, this is God. No, but to have a relationship with Krishna. So we all have an original relationship of love with Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We've been searching for that relationship throughout the universe without success. And we cannot have peace or happiness without finding Krishna. Fortunately, Krishna's right here. Krishna's in his holy name. Krishna has explained himself in this Bhagavad Gita. These are Krishna's words. Which, by the way, you can buy a case in the back room, see Mother Sri Vrindavan for a case of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna's words, to achieve the ultimate peace and to help others. So when we find individual peace, then we will help to bring peace in this world. Because we will know what is to be done, what is not to be done. We will know what is how to become happy. We will know how to become peaceful and how to give others peace. Prabhupada said, the only thing lacking in this world is Krishna consciousness, God consciousness. If we can bring God consciousness to the world, and particularly in this age of Kali, we have a very simple way, that's through the chanting of the holy name, through the Hare Krishna mantra, as Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came and delivered to us. If we bring this chanting of Hare Krishna to the world, then there will be peace. So thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Jai Bhagavad Gita Ki Jai. Hare Bol. Might be time for a comment, question, or reflection. Anybody has anything they'd like to add? Yes, Prabhu.
Thank you for your inspiring talk. My question is this, that you know, in relationship to all the suffering of the innocent animals on this whole planet, I think maybe 5 billion animals are killed every year. Yeah. And just to maybe take it down to a personal level, if I'm on the street in Vrindavan and I see a person in the mode of ignorance and they have a stick in their hand and he's beating a cow or a horse. Let's say a horse is pulling his bullock cart there and the horse is malnourished and isn't able to pull the cart and the owner's getting annoyed, so he starts beating the horse over the head and starts to attack the horse with the stick. And I'm standing there, okay, and I'm watching this. And okay, well, I'm not going to start preaching Krishna consciousness to this man who's in the mode of ignorance. I'm going to go over there and try and grab his stick and stop him from killing this innocent animal. So, just to take that onto a more global aspect, you know, is there a way, I know there's people who are doing cow protection, which is wonderful, but we're suffering the karma of the reaction of all these animals being killed. And coming from a place of Krishna consciousness, is there any additional ways that people could rise up, say, against these slaughterhouses, because we're all suffering from these wars. Innocent people are suffering from wars, even though I may not be eating meat and I'm not killing any animals, but a war negatively impacts on me.
Well, let me go back to your first example, and I think then we can extrapolate that on a larger scale. In your first example with a horse being beaten, it's probably, I could see why that might be a response that you'd want to do that, because it's right in front of you. You feel some personal responsibility to protect that animal. However, you can't protect probably every horse in that town, what to speak of every horse or cow within the whole country or the whole area. In other words, these things are going to go on in such a massive scale. That is why education is the real answer, and particularly spiritual education. That's what Srila Prabhupada always recommended. That's why Prabhupada printed these books, distributed these books. We have 500 million of Srila Prabhupada's books that are all across the globe right now, because really the best way to get people to change their activities, for people to act in a more pious way and stop these karmic reactions, which are causing all of us pain, is really through spiritual knowledge. So that we can make actual change. Now, Srila Prabhupada didn't encourage so much that we become like social activists or political activists. Sometimes there's a time and place, you know, and it might be valuable. And sometimes by working with those people, they might be very pious and receptive people that we can work with to help understand these greater goals and greater causes. But generally, Srila Prabhupada really, really stressed that we give people Krishna consciousness, give people to chant Hare Krishna, take prasadam, whatever, somehow purify their hearts, and that will bring about change.
Just a quick follow-up. So if a person is really in a demonic mentality, we're still trying to preach to them.
No. There's four types of people, and the demoniac person we ignore, we don't try to preach to. We preach to those who are pious, those who can hear. However, I mean, if you really want to push this to a certain point, if I saw someone trying to kill somebody on the street, would I try to stop them? Of course I would. Yeah, I mean, we're human beings, we're social, we live in the society, we have compassion for people who are suffering. I mean, naturally, you know, we would do what we needed to do in a given circumstance to protect people, animals, old men, children, women, cows, whatever. Right? In other words, these are protected classes of people, and we have an absolute obligation to give protection. And at the same time, we realize it's probably not going to be possible to protect everybody unless we have a major change of consciousness throughout the world. So, okay, any final one? I think we're over time, and prasadam is served. Okay, thank you so much. Hare Krishna. Jai Prabhupada.